Hello, I'm Robbie Rist. This is number 0547, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0547. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet lawyer Jacqueline Newman, who is the author of The New Rules of Divorce. In this modern age, you need to be very careful as to how you either email or text your impending ex.
People are very casual. And, you know, one of the problems with emails and text messages and all of that is that you want immediate responses. And then when you don't receive immediate responses, and especially when you're in the middle of a divorce and everything feels much more personal, and, you know, they'll be very angry when people don't respond right away. So one of the things I talk about in the book, and I also talk about with my clients, is I say that, you know, you should set rules with your ex as to how much time, you know, if someone sends an email, they should be responding and say 24 hours. If it's a text message, it should be a couple hours. You know, obviously, and if it's an emergency, you always make a phone call.
Andrew Umbrick is the manager of Tahkeenee Hot Pools in Whitehorse in the Yukon. They have the annual International Hair Freezing Contest.
From 2011 until 2015, it was a very small affair with very little fanfare. There were only a few participants, maybe 10 to 20 participants each year, and there was one prize worth $100. With one winner. Since 2015, it's grown quite a bit. In 2015, we went viral. We've since increased the number of categories and the prize money as well. So now we're at five categories of $2,000 each.
Ernie Smith from Tedium on the inventor of the scratch lottery ticket.
He's actually involved in this thing called the National Popular Vote, which has kind of gotten a lot of attention over the last year. Basically, it's sort of an attempt in the U.S. to try to get a bunch of states to agree to set aside all their electoral college votes towards the person who has won the popular vote. I had actually heard about this guy separately as a result of that, but then I was kind of researching a little bit and I had stumbled upon his name, and he was actually involved in inventing the scratch-off lottery ticket, which I was like, that's so random.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0547, was Robbie Rist, who is an actor, a musician, a producer, a voice talent, and one of the hosts of the Spoon podcast, which is one of the best podcasts on the planet. Thank you very much, Robbie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. The new coronavirus breakout, which started in Wuhan, China, but is spreading around the globe, is greatly confusing some panicky Americans. Google revealed that searches spiked for Corona beer virus, as well as beer virus without the name of the popular Mexican lager. The latter was actually used more overall, especially in New Mexico and Kansas, while the former was most popular in South Carolina and Colorado. Of course, the virus has nothing to do with beer. And by the way, at press time, there have been 9 known coronavirus cases in the U.S. with no deaths. Meanwhile, so far this season, at least 8,200 Americans have died of the flu, including 54 children. So, panic accordingly.
The Corona hotline is back, people. New year, new operator, same hotline.
Meanwhile, a person in Cape Coral, Florida, thought someone sent them coronavirus in the mail. The 911 caller told police that an empty package from China was delivered to their doorstep. With looming concerns about the sickness, the person called the police. The call prompted Cape Coral Fire Department to respond with their hazmat team. While there, a police officer called the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC said coronavirus cannot survive within a package, and there is no record of that ever happening. The virus spreads through droplets like a cough. Well, at least they didn't call, you know.
Corona hotline.
47-year-old Gregory Siepel of Ludlow Falls, Ohio, was arrested on January 30th after being accused of attacking a man with a knife during an argument over bacon. The unnamed victim told Miami County Sheriff's officers that he had made bacon that morning for breakfast, and Siepel took issue with the amount he had eaten. The argument escalated until Siepel allegedly grabbed the victim by the back of the head and held a razor blade to his neck, cutting him. Siepel was charged with felonious assault and was held on $50,000 bond.
Bacon? Gotta get that bacon! Yummy, crunchy bacon, bacon, bacon! Zum, yum, yum, it's bacon!
It's often said that you can't live high on the hog. Well, you know, we're in the midst of what I'd like to refer to as the biggest of the three Hallmark propaganda days of the year. Of course, I'm referring to Valentine's Day, and the other two being Mother's Day and Father's Day. I have two stories that herald in this allegedly heartwarming February event. The first one, if you have lifetime commitment on your mind this Valentine's Day, Domino's Australia wants to help out. The pizza chain announced a contest on February 3rd in which the winner will receive a diamond-encrusted engagement ring in the shape of a pizza slice worth $9,000. According to the company, fans can enter with a 30-second video detailing how you will involve pizza in your proposal. Wow. Could you imagine if, after going to all that trouble, she says no? How well will that go over with your shattered soul? Or with Domino's?
What's the most unlikely couple in the history of unlikely couples? Domino's and the Biggest Loser, of course. The good choice range from Domino's and the Biggest Loser. Domino's, it's all good.
Meanwhile, if you'd like to get a special gift for an ex this Valentine's Day, Center Wildlife Care in Port Matilda, Pennsylvania has just the thing. In exchange for a donation to a fund for restoring local bat populations, the rescue organization will name a mealworm after your ex, and Betsy, the large brown bat, will eat it. Donate more than $45 and you'll receive a personalized video of Betsy devouring the treat. Essentially, people will be naming the mealworms after someone they don't like, Executive Director Robin Grabowski said, and we will feed them to the bat. You know, I'm guessing that with the current climate in the U.S. these days, that a lot of those names won't be of exes, but rather, it'll be political.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of exes, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Divorce is the last thing that most people want to think about. But when it's inescapable, you'll want the best advice that's available. Divorce attorney Jacqueline Newman is the author of The New Rules of Divorce, 12 Secrets to Protect Your Wealth, Health, and Happiness. She joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. There's one aspect that I want to touch on when it comes to the new rules of divorce, and that's something that's a modern issue, and that is emails. And I guess a lot of people aren't aware of the importance of the casualness that one texts someone or emails someone and how that can play into a divorce.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, anytime you put something in writing, you're obviously taking a risk right there in itself. But secondly, people are very casual. And, you know, one of the problems with emails and text messages and all of that is that you want immediate responses. And then when you don't receive immediate responses, and especially when you're in the middle of a divorce and everything feels much more personal and maybe you're a little, you know, your sensitivities are a little heightened, then, you know, they'll be very angry when people don't respond right away. So one of the things I talk about in the book, and I also talk about with my clients, is I say that if you want to, you know, you should set rules with your ex as to how much time, you know, if someone sends an email, they should be responding and say 24 hours. If it's a text message, it should be a couple hours. You know, obviously, and if it's an emergency, always make a phone call. But we kind of talk about barrier, you know, we talk about rules and guidelines. And so therefore, hopefully, you know, people won't get so angry. because people do expect immediate responses, and that's really part of the problem.
But what if we're dealing with a couple, and it could be the male or the female, or same-sex couples for that matter, what if you're dealing with a couple and one person in that relationship, that now ending relationship, has a lackadaisical attitude toward emails and text messages, and the other does not? Does the one who does not expect the other person to suddenly change while they're going through a divorce proceeding?
I mean, they definitely expect it, and then when ultimately their expectations are not met, they become very, very angry. I mean, that's kind of what ends up happening. And you see that all the time. I mean, you see that in workplace. You see that, obviously, in any type of relationship. So, again, I think that's one of the reasons that I really try to kind of set barriers and set guidelines. So sometimes, you know, for an example, if, you know, you do have this person that, you know, is literally married to their phone, and every single time something comes up, they respond in 2 seconds. And then you have the other person who's like, I'll get to it when I get to it. You know, I really greatly encourage people to kind of have rules. And, you know, as long as they know they're sticking to their rules, the person who wants the response immediately, they know they might not get a response immediately. And they have this, you know, their ex-spouse has a 2-hour window or whatever it may be. And the other person knows, you know what, I might usually take 5 hours to get to them. I know I only should do it in 2, so I'll put it a little higher on my priority list.
Now, your book is The New Rules of Divorce. You're talking about issues like this in your book. But you're only dealing, as an attorney, with one side of the equation. Just because your client follows the rules that you would like he or she to follow in a divorce proceeding doesn't mean the other side's going to do that. So how do you coach your client on the possibility that while we might play by the so-called rules, the other side might not?
Yeah, I mean, you always have that. And, you know, that's like kind of in any sort of situation. I say, you know, you can only control what you can control. You know, a lot of times if I have, you know, an adversary on the other side who is on the same page with me about trying to really facilitate communication between these people, you know, they will encourage their client to do it as well. But I say, you know, the fact is everyone's going to try their best, but you have to expect the fact that you married this person. They're probably not going to change grossly when you divorce them. So the problems you had in the marriage are just going to be probably highlighted as an ex-spouse, and they just have to manage their expectations.
Now, some people, when they're getting divorced, like to drag everyone else into their so-called drama, which is what I find interesting in the tips that you have about emailing. You're saying do not CC anybody else in your emails to your ex.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I say that is because usually, so let's say someone CCs their sister or their brother or their best friend, then the responding spouse is going to know that they have an audience. And so either they're going to take that time to defend themselves to such a degree because they feel like they have to defend themselves to the other people that are on the email, or they're going to become, you know, incredibly aggressive because, or they won't respond at all because they don't want to engage in it. So, you know, look, the communication really should be between the two people. And I say, if you want your sister, or your brother, or whoever it is to see it, then forward it to them afterwards. But don't be put in the position where you're basically setting up a stage for this communication. And also, people sometimes don't want to be involved. So it makes everything awkward. And I think it makes, you know, what could be a small situation much bigger.
What's the biggest misconception or misunderstanding when it comes to emails with exes? And by that, I mean, is it the idea that forgetting the fact that an email is a paper trail, it's a permanent record? Or is it the fact that sometimes people don't necessarily understand the nuances of a person's phrasing or even, you know, their capitalization or emojis or whatever the case may be, that it's misinterpreted? What's the biggest faux pas here?
You know, I think it's kind of both. And, you know, one of the reasons that I think emails and any kind of text messages and stuff is very hard is that, so for an example, if I wrote an email and I said something, you know, benign to someone, they would read it and they'd say, okay, this is fine. But then if their ex writes it, you know, the ex, you hear the voice in your head and you have, you know, all of the history that comes in from whatever went on in that marriage. So like what could seem as like a pretty straightforward comment is going to may be seen as attacking, you know, in a voicemail. You know, they're going to read into probably the most negative tone possible. And, you know, it could be very, very damaging. And then what ends up happening is that person will lash out. And then the person who wrote it feels that I was just writing something innocent, you're lashing out. And that's where the war begins also, because it's really just a breakdown in that communication. But in regards to the first point that you raised, you know, it is important because, you know, a lot of people, when they're angry, they get behind a keyboard and become very, very brave. And then they just write and they write, you know, just nastiness all over the place. And they just write things that they don't even mean. And what ends up happening is that, you know, attorneys, you know, like us, we love those emails. And so we collect those emails and then we'll use them, you know, in motion papers or before a court to basically show how erratic someone is, how someone exaggerates, how someone lies. You know, it could really damage your credibility in a trial when you've written these emails that were just written in the heat of passion. You weren't thinking. But when writing this stuff down, you know, it can definitely come back and bite you.
In this day and age, the 21st century, where everyone is texting and everyone is emailing, is it even possible to advise your client no emails during the divorce proceeding, or is that just unpredictable in this day and age?
I think it's unpredictable. I don't think that people really communicate, you know, that's just the way people communicate. And so I don't think that it's, you know, logistically possible, especially when you have children, you're going back and forth and there's so many communications and, you know, people are at work, you know, unless you have the time to be on the phone all the time. And I'm not even against emails and texts as a way of communication, because I actually think, you know, they can keep you focused, because sometimes if you were to speak on the phone all the time, things are going to come up. I mean, communication and conversations are going to go to a place you didn't want them to be. You may be calling just to see what time, you know, we're picking up Bobby for dinner, and then it all of a sudden spews to, you know, all the horrible things that happened in the marriage. So the thing I like about email and text is that they can get answers to your questions very, very succinctly, you know, very directed. I mean, the other thing I talk about in the book about that is that you want to keep your emails short. You want to keep, you know, no more than 3 topics in an email. You want to keep them, you know, you want to number them. If it's possible to say that you want them to either be yes or no answers, that's always great. Like I always say to my clients, you can write Y and Y. That's fine, because you've communicated, you've gotten it across, and we didn't go anywhere we didn't need to go. So I think that the way you structure your email is also a very important thing.
One of the 10 tips you mentioned is try to end all emails on a positive note, even if you don't mean it. That might be tough for some people.
It's definitely tough for some people. I realize it's a tall order, but, you know, again, this goes back to what we were talking about with the tone. If, you know, if you can end it positively, that someone really can't construe that as you in some way being negative, you're always going to be better off. And I think that people are going to respond to emails if it ends positively. If it ends negatively and you're attacking, most people don't want to deal with that. And then you won't get the answers to the questions you're really asking. Instead, you're going to get nastiness back. And then communication hasn't gotten you anywhere and all you've gotten is frustrated.
Are you concerned that the other side might be somewhat suspicious? You know, the other side thinking, well, my ex was never that nice to me. Why are they being nice to me at the end of this email?
Oh, absolutely. But you know what? That's okay. You know, they may, you know, a lot of times you have people that say, oh, all of a sudden now that attorneys are watching, you're being nice, or all of a sudden you're showing interest in the children when you didn't before. And, you know, my attitude is that, you know what, let him or her be nice, you know, enjoy the fact they're being nice. I don't really care why they're being nice, but they're not being nasty. So it's okay. And same thing with being involved with the children. I say, great. So now your child is getting more and more love and attention. That's not a bad thing. It's late, and you know their motives may not be genuine, but, you know, so what? Everybody benefits from it.
Now, as I mentioned, we're focusing on the emails, but your book, The New Rules of Divorce, has much more than just this. What are some of the other new rules that, you know, a lot of people might not even think about until it's too late?
One of the things that I just wanted to call attention to in this book was about the fact that custody has really changed. You know, back in the day, it was, you know, fathers had every other weekend and Wednesday night dinners, and that's just not happening anymore. Now you're having a lot of fathers that are having 50-50 time with their kids. They're much more engaged, and courts are very, very supportive of that. And I think that, you know, so many people just don't believe that's going to happen, and it really is happening, to the point that I think we're slowly getting to the place where if you don't want it to be 50-50 custody, you're going to have to explain why. So there's been a huge shift in it. I think most people don't recognize that that's happening, fathers and mothers. So it's, you know, definitely something I focus on in the book. I give a real, you know, a lot of explanation about that. And I just think it's an important thing for people to know.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. The book is The New Rules of Divorce. It's a topic that we wish that no one would have to look at, but statistically speaking, more than 50% of the population will. So congratulations for you publishing this book. I thank you very much, Jacqueline, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jacqueline Newman, author of The New Rules of Divorce, 12 Secrets to Protect Your Wealth, Health, and Happiness. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0547, and you'll find links to Jacqueline's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the International Hair Freezing Contest. Ernie Smith is along from Tedium with the invention of the scratch lottery ticket. And we have an idiot of the day coming your way. And lots more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. 44-year-old Santore Thomas of Detroit presented three checks at his bank on January 21st that he had received as settlement in a race discrimination lawsuit against his former employer. Instead of accepting the checks, TCF Bank in Livonia, where Thomas has been an established customer for quite some time, summoned police and initiated a fraud investigation. Thomas's attorney, Deborah Gordon, said, "Obviously, assumptions were made the minute he walked in based on his race. Thomas finally closed his existing accounts, left the bank, and deposited the checks at a different bank without any trouble." The next day, Thomas filed a lawsuit against TCF Bank, alleging race discrimination and asking for unspecified damages and an apology from the company.
Life is unpredictable. TCF Bank is here to help.
Well, that all depends on where you fall in the Sherwin-Williams color palette. David Baird of Yukon, Oklahoma, took up arms against his neighbor, John Stafford, after Stafford went on a bizarrely violent rant on February 5th. Stafford assaulted the neighborhood for 12 hours, throwing feces into Baird's yard and trying to break down a fence using a Roomba vacuum cleaner. As he and his family took shelter in their home, Baird warned Stafford, "If you break through this fence, I will have to shoot you." Finally, the bomb squad and SWAT teams were called in, and Stafford barricaded himself inside his home, making 6 911 calls during the ordeal. "I am going to run you guys into the bleeping ground," he said during one. "Okay, have a nice night," the dispatcher replied. Eventually, officers released cans of pepper spray to budge Stafford from his house. He was charged with planning an act of violence. Exactly how was he planning to break through a fence with a Roomba vacuum cleaner? Did he have that thing supercharged, or was that an extremely weak fence? Aren't Roombas supposed to turn around the moment they hit something? Anything? Just asking. Anyway. 36-year-old Daniel Christopher Booth had warrants for his arrest for allegedly selling meth. This according to the Suwanee County, Florida Sheriff's Office. Suwanee, how I love you, how I love you. Booth works in construction, and deputies went to the job site to arrest him, but he ran. Booth jumped into a pond to escape a police dog, but deputies just waited until Booth finally had to come up for air. A charge of resisting arrest was added when he was booked into jail. Well, no matter how you cut it, he's definitely going up the river. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, getting drugs into prison isn't easy. Still, there are people who will try extremely creative ways to smuggle contraband in. One Kentucky inmate lit upon an idea of soaking his underwear in methadone. 55-year-old Michael Jones was let out of the Jessamine County Detention Center on a court-ordered furlough to attend a funeral. He must have thought he was pretty clever when he came up with the idea to smuggle the drugs back into prison in his underwear. Police say Jones cut the briefs and shared them with his fellow inmates, including 33-year-old Corey McQuarrie. Okay, if your last name is McQuarrie, why would you name your kid Corey? Seriously. Anyway, McQuarrie must have gotten more than his fair share of the briefs because officers found him unresponsive in his cell. He was pronounced dead later that day. An autopsy report has not been released, but police suspect he died of an opiate overdose. When somebody comes in the facility, either from a furlough or any other occurrence, they're searched. Their clothing's searched, strip searched, any other type of search that we feel is necessary, prison jailer John Sally said. If something is in their garment and it's colorless and odorless, it would be very difficult, almost impossible to detect from the naked eye. Okay, I have one question here. Just one. I mean, the only way you could consume those drugs would be by either chewing or sucking on the underwear. How much do you have to be jonesing for a fix that you would chew on another man's sweaty underwear? And I said sweat, but that's the least of the problems here. Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? If you're looking to instantly transform your hairstyle, then you might want to head to Takini Hot Pools in Whitehorse in the Yukon. The natural hot springs there make it possible to bathe outdoors in extreme freezing weather, resulting in some impressive hairdos. As a result, it's the home of the annual International Hair Freezing Contest. To talk about the contest, we are joined by Andrew Umbrick, the manager of Takini Hot Pools. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So how long has this contest been going, and how did it get started?
So it started in 2011. We had a manager at the time who thought of the idea and started the contest. But from 2011 until 2015, it was a very small affair with very little fanfare. There were only a few participants, maybe 10 to 20 participants each year. And there was one prize worth $100 with one winner. Since 2015, it's grown quite a bit. In 2015, we went viral. And we've since increased the number of categories and the prize money as well. So now we're at five categories of $2,000 each.
You went viral in 2015. What exactly was it that kind of put you over the hump?
We had this one amazing group photo. These guys had put a lot of work into their photo and to their hair, and they had done more effort than any other participant in the past, and it was just enough to make it viral worthy. Most people in the world can't freeze their hair like that comfortably.
Now, I know we all heard...
You have to be in a specific location.
I know we all heard from our mothers about not going out with wet hair on a cold day and all the trouble that can cause. So it must be quite shocking to some people to see what you guys are doing with this contest every year.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's fake, actually. A lot of people don't realize that the participants are sitting in a hot spring that's 42 degrees Celsius. So they're perfectly comfortable. Sometimes their ears or noses get a little bit cold, but that can be mitigated with earmuffs. But so a lot of people get kind of see this and get a little bit of a shock because not everyone in the world gets cold temperatures or much of a winter at all or snow. And then here we are, we have people freezing their hair, their eyelashes, their mustache, any facial hair or body hair that's exposed to the cold at minus 20 degrees or colder just turns white.
So, again, the water, you say, is plus 42 degrees on the Celsius scale, which makes it comfortable for them to be in the hot springs. When you stick your head out of the water, how quickly does it freeze to some of those shots that we've seen on your website and other places?
So currently on our website, all the best photos were taken during a three-week period we just had of minus 40. So when it's minus 40 degrees below, that's really the ideal. You're sitting in water that's 42 degrees Celsius, and all the steam coming from the water is gathering onto your hair and then meeting the cool air and then freezing. And it takes about 10 minutes to 30 minutes, 10 to 30 minutes to get a truly amazing frozen hairstyle. When it's minus 20, it can take a little bit longer, maybe a half hour to an hour. But at minus 40, it really doesn't take very much time. In fact, it can be so fast that people can try multiple hairstyles in one evening and submit multiple photos.
Well, I was about to ask, how do they go about doing the hairstyles? Do they sit in the hot spring with a comb? Do they tease it in any way? Do they do that with just their hands? How does it work?
Previously, people would just kind of wet their hair and then get some friends to maybe hold it up, or they would lay it on the side of the pool until it froze, and then they would prop it up, or they would just let it freeze as a big tangle. This year, since we're offering a lot more prize money, people have gotten more creative and put a little more effort into it. People have brought multiple friends to hold hair in positions. They've brought accessories to freeze. Some people use spray bottles to increase to add more moisture to the hair to just increase the freezing. Some people have even put wire in their hair to get the freezing process started and then removed it just to keep the desired shape.
And again, how long does it take it to freeze generally when it's optimal cold weather temperature?
10 minutes to 30 minutes.
10 to 30 minutes. Wow. So
just depends how much hair you have. And yeah.
As I've mentioned in the introduction, it's an international contest. So how big has it become on an international scale?
Well, I would say in previous years, the number of participants have been about 50-50, either 50% from the Yukon or 50% from Canada or other countries around the world. This year, the contest isn't done yet, so I don't have all the stats, but I know we have at least 30 or 40 submissions from outside Canada. So from the States or from Germany, from Japan, from France. We've got some from all over the place, really.
And we should mention that the way the contest works are people take selfies of themselves in the water, and they must be accepted by March the 8th, that's coming up, and that the official winners will be will be taking place on the 15th of March. That's correct?
That's right. Now, previously, we asked people to submit their own photos. This year, we changed it a little bit. We increased the infrastructure of our contest. We added a wireless doorbell outside, so when people are ready, they ring the doorbell, my staff comes out, and they take their photo. A lot of people don't know how to take nice photos when there's that much steam, if they don't have the proper lighting, and as a result, this year, we've gotten much better photos because we've been able to control the quality, I should say, a little bit better than in previous years. Sometimes self-submitted cell phone photos are pretty blurry or really low resolution.
I have seen some of the photos. They're absolutely astounding. And I've seen some of the videos, one of the things I found interesting was how you'd see these people with freezing hair, and there was one shot where somebody just dipped below the water, and you could see it instantly, for lack of a better term, thaw out. It's amazing how quickly it changes from one to the other, and in some cases, back.
Yeah, so the layer of frost on your hair is really just a superficial layer of frost. It's not at the point where you're going to break your hair. You would have to be outside for a lot longer for that to happen. So people don't damage their hair at all or injure it in any way. So as soon as you dip it into the water, it just instantly thaws out. There's no waiting period. And then once you get your hair back out exposed to the air, it'll be another 10 to 30 minutes. Now, 10 to 30 minutes gets you that really white, frosty look, but your hair starts to freeze much quicker than that. Your eyelashes and eyebrows will start to gather frost within minutes.
With this contest going viral in 2015, how has that helped overall Tokini Hot Pools? What kind of notoriety and what kind of interest has your organization, your facility had since this contest started?
Well, in 2015, after we went viral, we won the Yukon Territorial Award for Tourism, and then we won a federal tourism award as well in 2015. So that was a really nice way to recognize the hair freezing contest. But every year since, it's gone viral, and every year our hot springs gains more attention and more notoriety, and we're just hoping to keep the momentum up, because at the end of this year, our new hot springs facility will be done being built, and it will be replacing a 45-year-old hot springs facility. So we're hoping with our new facility, it'll even draw more people to our territory and into our contest.
Excellent. I urge people to go to the website, which is TakiniHotPools.com, and they can find out more information about your facility. Now, besides the fact that you are now world known for this international hair freezing competition, tell us some of the other attributes, not just in the winter, but year round. What's the draw to Takini Hot Pools?
There's a lot of things to do in Whitehorse. We have a large winter season, so there's a lot of winter sports. If you like skiing, if you like Northern Lights, we're an excellent location to see it. We've got beautiful mountains, and we have a lot of wildlife. So right next to my hot springs, there's actually a wildlife preserve where you can see all the northern animals. You can see bison, you can see caribou, moose, lynx, foxes, basically all the northern animals except for a bear or a wolf.
Wow.
So if you're looking for a wilderness experience, the Yukon is a good place to do it. And at our hot springs, even if it's minus 40 degrees outside, you're still comfortable in the water.
Excellent.
And not a lot of people are very active at minus 40. It makes people kind of hunker down and hermit up in their homes.
And again, people can go to the website and see more information about your location and also more about the contest as well, correct?
Yes, and I would encourage everyone, they can check my company's website, TakiniHotSprings.com, or they can go to HairFreezingContest.com, and there they can see all the photos, and they can like, if they like any photos, they can click like or share them on Facebook.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Andrew, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
No problem. Thank you for calling.
Andrew Umbrick, the manager of Takini Hot Pools. As you heard him mention, you can see the gallery of photos from previous contests by going to hairfreezingcontest.com. You can also visit the resort site at TakiniHotPools.com. And you can go to my website at thestuffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0547, and you'll find links to both sites. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test lizard.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the invention of scratch lottery tickets. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way and more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also on Spotify. Well, chaos erupted outside a popular Brooklyn brewery on Friday night when an apparently annoyed craft beer hater pulled a gun on a long line of people who were waiting to buy the latest designer IPA. No shots were fired during the squabble outside the Other Half Brewing Company in Carroll Gardens, and a suspect was being questioned. The gunslinging skeptic struck around the corner from the brewery, where beer lovers with camp chairs and hand trucks regularly line up overnight to buy limited-run $18 four-packs in collectible cans sold when the doors open Saturday mornings. It was around 9 p.m. when the gunman and a woman he was with allegedly confronted the long line of hops hipsters. The pair, who were staying at an Airbnb, began mocking the beer lovers for standing in line overnight for the release of 10 beers with names like Bourbon Barrel Age Bananiversary Imperial Stout and All 6th Anniversary Everything Chocolate Peanut Butter Crunchy Imperial Stout. First, the taunts flew, then some of the camp chairs. The belligerent couple disappeared back into the apartment building. Soon afterward, the man came back outside to glare at the line again, this time with a gun in his hand. The pro-craft beer folks promptly called the cops on the anti-craft beer gunman. According to witnesses, 30 seconds later, like 8 cop cars came down. The last the beer lovers saw of the gunman was when cops hauled him out of the apartment building in handcuffs. The folks in line confirmed his identity, and the cops took him away. A slightly amusing story about a drunk guy with a gun harassing hipster beer buyers in line. Would this be considered a brouhaha? Yes. And finally, two 16-year-old boys went snowboarding in the backcountry near the Whitewater Ski Resort and were reported missing when they didn't return as scheduled. Search efforts were hampered by bad weather, so they spent the night in the wild, but the next day a helicopter found the boys and brought them out. "They're extremely lucky," said Jim Kyle of Nelson, B.C. Search and Rescue. "They survived by building a fire." One of the boys, Kyle said, had homework in his backpack, and that definitely helped keep the fire going. Well, that's certainly a better excuse than blaming the dog. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back. And this time, he's here to scratch an itch. One of his recent items deals with scratching of all kinds, but the part that caught my eye was the invention of the scratch-off lottery ticket. To talk about it, Ernie joins us once again via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program once again. I'm always amazed and marvel at the various variety of topics you come up with that people sometimes don't think of. And again, you got me with this one. Your Scratching an Itch article, which also, as I mentioned, deals with lottery tickets. How did you come up with this one, and where did you find the story about this guy?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'd actually heard about, he's actually involved in this thing called the National Popular Vote, which has kind of gotten a lot of attention over the last year. Basically, it's sort of an attempt in the U.S. to try to get a bunch of states to agree to set aside all their electoral college votes towards the person who has won the popular vote. And while they haven't gotten there yet, they're close enough to half that, like, people are starting to take it somewhat seriously. So I had actually heard about this guy separately as a result of that, but then I was kind of researching a little bit, and I had stumbled upon his name, and he was actually involved in inventing the scratch-off lottery ticket, which I was like, that's so random.
Okay, so this guy's name again is?
John Koza.
John Koza. And is it one of those situations like, a Post-it notes and other things where he came across this by accident, or was this his goal?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when he was in college, he was one of the first computer science graduates at the University of Michigan. And what was really interesting was that while he was in school, he had a job working for a company that specialized in sweepstakes called J&H International. Basically, what they did was they actually used the basic technology, you know, on paper, sort of the lacquer-based finish that, like, covers up other things. What ended up happening was that he and another employee at this company came up with an idea to sort of add the idea of chance to these. Basically, Koza, being a computer science graduate, he came up with the idea of sort of coming up with algorithms to randomize the numbers that showed up on these cards.
There are so many inventions out there, or innovations, such as the intermittent wiper, the aforementioned post-it notes, and this, where people come up with something, their name might go down in history, but they're none the wiser, or certainly none the richer, for what they've done. This guy at least become, potentially wealthy on creating this concept?
Actually, he became very wealthy. While he's mostly worked in academia, he spent time at Stanford as a professor of computer science. He actually started a fresh company after G&H International shut down, called Scientific Games. And that company, to this day, makes these scratch-off lottery tickets and also has a broader business working in casinos and selling slot machines and stuff. So it's kind of run into the situation where, like, this idea that he had that he founded was so successful that the company is around today and is responsible for much of the modern gambling apparatus, as I guess you could put it.
Now, one of the things I noticed in the article, and there are several things, as I said, your article is about scratching of all kinds. So you have in there five fascinating facts about scratching things on the human body, which we're not going to get to, but people can go to your, tedium.co and find it. But one of the things that's also interesting is you can make your own scratch.
Yeah, you can actually, there are a number of videos on YouTube that kind of show it, but sort of what's possible is that if you create a sheet of paper with a glossy surface, which is probably the easy way to do it is to basically take some packing tape and just put that on a sheet of like cardstock. You can actually cover it with a mixture of acrylic paint, usually silver colored, obviously, and dish soap, and use that to cover the glossy paint. And what happens is because the gloss is there, it kind of prevents the paint from binding to the paper, which makes it easy to scratch off.
Why would someone want to make their own scratch off?
Because they're really creative and they make a lot of crafts.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. The other thing that you talk about is beyond scratching, and that is scratch and sniff.
And yes.
I've never understood why this is a thing. But then again, I guess I don't read a lot of fashion magazines. But why is this a thing? How did this become a thing?
Well, it's interesting because the thing that made scratch and sniff possible was the invention of carbonless copy paper. Carbon paper, like many decades ago, became well known for allowing people to basically write forms, multiple times just by running carbon through the sheet, which, is a useful innovation. Carbonless paper basically allowed the use of chemicals to be sort of, in very small form to be mixed into the paper so that the extra use of carbon wasn't necessary. Like basically the paper was specialized and it had like an extra layer in there that had like, micro capsules of like ink that could then make the impression on lower sheets of paper. 3M, which is a company that does a lot of things, like I mentioned in the piece, that they sold a lot of floppy disks in the 80s and 90s. They made their own version of it, and they figured out at some point that you could actually use the microcapsules that were intended for this carbonless copy paper to contain scents inside of the paper that could be scratched off.
By the way, I, though I don't use it, I still have carbon paper, just to let you know.
I love carbon paper. I think it's pretty cool.
I don't know why I still have it, but I still have some. So when you went down this rabbit hole, which I guess it's something that inherently you end up doing based on just what you do. You started with this guy because you were following this story that dealt with elections. You went down this rabbit hole about the guy who created the lottery ticket, the scratchy lottery ticket, and then you went on a scratching journey. How did that happen? Like, what led to, I mean, from scratching lotteries to scratch and sniff to scratching the body, how did that pan out?
You know, it's interesting because I think that, like, I kind of approached it from the perspective of, here's this thing that people do all the time that, you know, it's sort of like we have these touch interfaces that we like work with all the time. And for some reason, scratching as a concept is not translated to our smartphones or our tablets. And that kind of got me to thinking a little bit more broadly about the topic, which obviously it's sort of like the ultimate, like, purely analog gesture that we still have.
And you did actually, in the piece near the end, talk a little bit about scratching and modern technology. So you did kind of answer or foreshadow what you were looking for in the first place.
Yeah, I did. I featured a guy, a researcher from France, focuses on user interfaces. His name's Marc Tessier. I could be getting that a little bit wrong, but you know, hopefully I got it right. Hopefully, Mark. And basically what he did is he created like sort of a smartphone case that looks a lot like human skin for some reason. He basically made it because he wanted to like have like an interface on his phone that could be pinched. But because it's made of, because it looks like human skin, one, it looks disgusting, and two, it can like do things like you can scratch it and you can tickle it or what have you, which it kind of makes one wonder what we haven't managed to pull off in terms of our touchscreen interfaces just yet.
It also sounds like a future episode of Criminal Minds, if you ask me. It's a little on the creepy side. The articles, like I say, always fascinating. It's great. It's a great read to go to tedium.co and check out some of the great stories that you write about, like this one that, again, it's called Scratching an Itch, and it's a fascinating read from top to bottom. There are so many other things we can talk about in this particular story, and there are so many other things we can talk about with other stories of yours. People should just go to your website and take a look at it. Ernie, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again. By the way, one last quick question. Do you buy scratch tickets?
You know, it's weird because usually I get them as gifts, and I'll scratch them in those cases, but I don't know. I try to limit my lottery purchases.
Okay. Ernie, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0547, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Two men charged with drug trafficking could have done a better job hiding their wares. More on that in a moment. Ian Simmons and Joshua Reinhardt, both 34, were pulled over in Santa Rosa County, Florida, after a trooper clocked them going 95 miles an hour on Interstate 10 on the state's panhandle. The trooper determined that Reinhardt was the subject of an active felony warrant for violation of probation in Orange County. He requested backup. A Santa Rosa County Sheriff's deputy arrived to assist, and a canine alerted to the presence of contraband in the vehicle. Authorities found approximately 75 grams of methamphetamine, 1.36 kilograms of the date rape drug GHB, 1 gram of cocaine, 3.6 grams of fentanyl, 15 MDMA tablets, and drug paraphernalia. Both men were charged with trafficking in methamphetamine and GHB, 3 counts of possession of a controlled substance, and possession of drug paraphernalia. As the police mentioned on their Facebook page, note to self, do not traffic your illegal narcotics in bags labeled bag full of drugs. They also wrote, our canines can read. By the way, there is no truth to the rumor that they were driving in a vehicle with decals stating, car full of morons. I mean, why, oh why, would you stash all of your illegal narcotics in a satchel marked bag full of drugs? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0547. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0547. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know. And okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.